black hair or something, I don't know. But I'm really not that person. And I harmed them tremendously. I loved my mother, but she was not what I wanted. I wanted Rob and Laura Petrie. I wanted something different than what I got. And retrospectively, and it took a long time, I did everything and anything I could to hurt her. I did anything and everything I could to strike her in the heart because of her mental illnesses. I would have done anything I could to hurt my mother. Her crying was music to my ears. I did anything and everything I could at times to hurt her, even when it took more effort than not hurting her. I blamed her for everything. I blamed my dad. My dad loved me, and he was a great guy. But you know what? I blamed him because he was 60 years old when I entered grammar school. He was older than many of the grandparents of my friends. He was not one generation in front of me. He was two. And he never could do the things with me that a little boy is supposed to do with his dad. He never played ball with me. We never rode bikes together. We never did the things that little boys are supposed to do with their dad. And when I saw Wally and Beaver doing their things with their dad, and I saw, you know, Make Room for Daddy and all these other various, you know, my dad didn't come to the dinner table with a suit on, and my mom didn't come to the dinner table wearing a dress and pearls. We had something very, very different. We had screaming and yelling and pots and pans flying through the air and insults and every other thing. My home was a battleground, and I resented them for it. And I had also resentments against people that are dead in terms of some of the teachers that I had and some of the people that I will never, ever get to run into again. I tried to find some of them, and I can't. So the eighth step becomes extremely important for me. I also had resentments against people that I will never meet. I had resentments against the people who killed my father's family. I had resentments against people who ordered their deaths. I had resentments against all of those various things of people, places, and institutions that I will never, ever get to make amends to. What am I going to do about them? Well, I'm going to come to an understanding that I would write those amends if I could, that I would forgive them if I could. And what I had to do with my eighth step amends, particularly in the area of my mom and dad, was I had to do several things. Number one, I had to write them letters. The first couple of letters I wrote, my sponsor called me filthy, dirty names and used a lot of golf words and said, this isn't an effing letter, this is an indictment. And he tore it up in front of my face. And he threw it in the garbage can. Then I did it again, and he tore it up again, and I did it again, and he tore it up again. And on the fourth or fifth try, he said, okay. I was still trying to reach out to my mother and say, damn you. What happened was miraculous. Electric. Miraculous. Supernatural. It took me about 10 years in program, just 10, 15 years in program, and I came to understand something about my mother and my father. I came to understand that I did not choose this situation, and I didn't cause it, and I can't cure it, and I can't control it. About another 10 to 15 years later of doing lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of work, I came to this conclusion that, excuse me, they didn't choose it either. My dad didn't choose the murder and the mayhem that forced him into this country. My father didn't choose the unbelievable insanity that wrecked his life. My mother did not choose her mental illness. They did not choose their eating disorders. They did not choose their situations. And there was forgiveness. There was love. There was understanding that I only wish to God I could have expressed to them while they were alive. And I know that there is another thing I can do for them to make amends to them too. I can recover. I can work my program, because what they would have wanted for their only child was recovery. What they would have wanted for me is to live like I'm living now instead of like I lived then. In filth, in squalor, in upheaval, in screaming, in food, in yelling. In my home, a flat tire had exactly the same urgency and importance as someone being diagnosed with a fatal illness. Everything was a 10. Today, I don't have to live that way. Today, I forgive them. Today, I love them. And when I'm out there early in the morning, I do my walking. Now, I've had two hips replaced in the last 2 years, and I need my knee replaced in June, June the 15th. I do my walking. I used to walk 6 miles a day. Now I'm down to twos and threes, but I'm doing it. When I'm done, I feel them with me. They know I've done the best I could. They are alive today in a way that they were not during their actual physical presence. And they are alive in my daughter. They are alive in the hopes and dreams that I have for her. I now understand that they had for me. When my daughter was about 10 minutes old, I walked her into the neonatal intensive care unit at Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene, Oregon. She was very sick, and they did not expect her to live. They had prepared us that she would be blind and deaf with cerebral palsy. She was born with none of those things. She has some situations, but she's none of those things. And when she was about 10 minutes old, we were going to go into the neonatal intensive care unit, and my wife was going to stay behind, obviously, and I was going to take Hannah into the neonatal intensive care, the NICU. And they said to me, "Do you want to carry her in there?" And I said, "Sure." They said, "Are you okay with that? Because we'll take her." And I said, no, I'll do it. And I carried her into her little isolette, and my 10-minute-old daughter was being hooked up to intravenous and all kinds of things, and they stuck needles in her feet, and she started to cry and thrash around in the isolette, and I got it just that quick. I looked up and I said, "I get it, Ma. I now get it, Mom. I am so sorry for what I did to you. I get it, Dad. I really get it, Pa. I get it. I now know it." And in the birth of my daughter came the birth of my ability to open up those floodgates and forgive them and embrace them and love them and accept the love that they had for me. Am I going to get to do a ninth step with them? Not in the here and now sense, but it's very real for me. And I don't know that my words are even expressing what I want to tell you. That amends to my mom and dad is very, very real to me. They did the best they could. They are beyond our sight and beyond our hearing. And they need to be forgiven, not because of them, but because I deserve not to be angry anymore. I deserve not to carry around that bag of barbells, which only led to more and more food, more and more frustration, and was exhausting. For years after my mother's death, I would think about how much I hated her guts. I don't have to spend that time anymore. I don't have to waste time doing that anymore. I can spend the same amount of time praying for her soul. I can spend the same amount of time loving her. I can spend the same amount of time doing the things in my program and to help my child that I know she would have me do. And me and my wife don't live that way, with pots and pans flying through the air and yelling and screaming. We have our moments, don't get me wrong, but we don't live that way. And I was real clear on that before we ever got married. I will not live that way. I've had enough of that. And we don't, because we're both in program. My wife is black belt yelling on, buddy boy. She is black belt yelling on. So the eighth step is a very clear, very distinct step. And when I go to a step meeting, eventually it kind of, you'll hear in the sharing, it'll kind of go to nine. Remember that eight is a definite step unto itself. And that I need to be ready to right those wrongs. Now, my amends, I never kissed anybody's girlfriend or I never kissed anybody's wife. Too bad for me. But my amends were mostly money amends. But in each and every person sitting in this room, there are amends. And once again, it's my faith, it's my belief in God that will help me to get the direction I need to take that action. And what I had to do in my life was I had to make up my mind that I was either going to do this or I wasn't. I either believe or I don't. God is everything or He's nothing. And when I believe that God is everything, it gives me the direction to move forward. And here is where I'm going to start clearing up that wreckage. And if you remember, we said that the steps have duality in their purpose. They're going to free me of the mental obsession, yes, but they're also going to make me right with God, right with myself, and right with my fellow human being. And when I stare forth and I make these amends, I don't have to live looking over my shoulder anymore. I can be free of that. So let's see the specific instructions, and I hope that kind of brings to life a little bit between the eighth and the ninth as being separate and distinct steps. George, where am I? Where? Oh. Where? Oh, because my book flipped over there. Yeah. What page are you on? 76, okay. Okay, now we need more action, is that it? Okay, because my page had flipped over. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all, I think we did this one already. We have a list of all persons we had harmed to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, here's your step zero reference. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Step zero is on page 58. It says if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Here is another step zero reference. He's calling back to that sentence. Okay. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. There's that Oxford group expression, maximum service. Maximum service to God and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. We lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores. Why lay ourselves, open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. In other words, I owe Sam $5,000. He's going to be real impressed with my attempt to live according to spiritual principles, and then at the end he's going to say, by the way, where's my $5,000? So I need to demonstrate through action that I'm paying him back. If I can't pay him back all at once, I start making payments. All that's required of me is willingness. I had to go to these people and I had to start sending them a monthly stipend. And eventually I looked around one day and it was gone. If you owe somebody a lot of money and you know you can't pay it back in one hunk, start sending them something every month. Great oaks are felled by small strokes. You look around, some of the people I owed money to, when I went to them to make amends to them, they accepted my amends and tore up the bills. And some of the people said, yes, that's very good, but now where's my money? So it's up to them. What I'm instructed to do is what it says in the book, following the directions. That's what I'm supposed to do. Okay, we don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God, when it will serve any good purpose. We are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with the person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill will and expressing our regret. There are people sitting in this room, including me, who have to go and make amends to people, and we are absolutely sure that they did us more harm than we did them, that they were absolutely dastardly in their intent. The big book tells me not to think about that. The big book tells me not to consider it. The big book tells me shovel your own driveway. Shovel your own snow. Leave the rest up to him. Don't judge. Don't, in other words, stop thinking is what I had to do. I had to be out of ideas on how I was going to do this my way myself. I had to be bereft of thought. Okay. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. If my manner is hysterical, angry, and crazy, then the results are going to suck. I'm told here what to do. Calm, frank, and open. Not secretive, angry, screaming, yelling, or going in begrudgingly. I'm there because I want to be there. I want to be there because I can't live this way anymore. I want to be there because if I don't get there, I'm going to go to McDonald's and they're going to play the graduation song, "Welcome to McDonald's, may I take your order please?" And I don't want to hear that song again. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own faults, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It is water over the dam. You go to somebody, you want to make amends to them, and they're rude to you, they throw you out, you're done. You're done. You don't have to resent them. It's okay. You've done what you needed to do. The rest is up to God. Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors, telling them what we are trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know about it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. What I need to remember that this is telling me, I need to just do the work. I need to face these things. I've been running from them a long time, and the devil I'm running from has greater dominion over me than the one I turn and face. If I turn and face it, it will see the light of day. If I run from it, the disease will propagate. It will grow in darkness. The recovery wants light. The illness wants darkness. And if I continue to run and make excuses and delay it, I'm not going to recover. I don't need any more evidence than that to go out and do these amends. All I need to know is if I don't do them, I'm going to eat again, and I don't want to. Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short on our accounts and unable to make in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we are sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense, such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried but haven't kept up the alimony to number one. She's indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble, too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves, here's again a step zero reference, that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing, we have to be. We must not shrink at anything. And if I have faith and I have my step two done and I have a God that works in my life, I'm going to be okay. Usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be hasty and foolish martyr who would need. We are not to be the hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. A man we know had remarried. Because of resentment and drinking, he had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life and had secured a position and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, "Here I am." We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary, but if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife, admitting his fault and asking forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money. He told her that he would try to do what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course, she did not, and the whole situation since has been adjusted. Before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, asked God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. This brings to mind a story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival, giving him no receipt for it. He subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. He felt that he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. If he opened the old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? After consulting with his wife and partner, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than to stand before his Creator guilty of such ruinous slander. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again and all would be lost anyhow. He attended church for the first time in many years. After the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His action met widespread approval, and today he is one of the most trusted citizens of his town. This all happened years ago. The chances are we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely and sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further, though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found that this is the best course of action to take. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It can be as good for the wife as for the husband. If we can forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not needlessly name a person upon whom she can vent jealousy. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. It may be both will decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is let bygones be bygones. Each might pray about it, having the other one's happiness uppermost in their mind, keeping it always in sight that we are dealing with that most terrible human emotion, jealousy. Good generalship may decide that the problem be attacked on the flank rather than risk a face-to-face combat. If we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't, but he is a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderable habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came up out of the cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" Every alcoholic, every compulsive overeater, every drug addict, on average, takes 7 people to hell with them. Every addict normally will take people to places they do not want to go. The pain is unbelievable. The shame is unbelievable. The unbelievable upheaval in the lives of the compulsive overeater and to those around them is almost unbearable. And yet, there are many people that I have hurt that were strong and they loved me and they hung in there with me. And I hurt them, and I lied to them, and I took their money, and I deceived them, and I screamed at them, and I swore at them, and I wished them dead. And they loved me anyway. I just got through telling you about my parents. Maybe in your life it's someone else. Maybe it's a child, maybe it's a relative, maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's a significant other of some kind or another. Not eating is like me saying, "Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" I must clear the wreckage of my past. I must, or I will eat again. I want to, or I will eat again. I love doing it. because I don't want to eat again. Bottom line, I must learn to live in God's world as a human being with failings and defects. I would have done better had I known better. I would have done better if I was better. I would have done better if I wasn't so afflicted. But that is behind me now. What will I do now? What action will I take now? And the big book tells me exactly what to do and what not to do. I do not have the right to knock on the door and say, Joe, I've been kissing your wife for 10 years. I do not have the right to go home and tell my wife, Wife, I've been kissing Susie down the street for 10 years. Do not have the right to do that because it's going to hurt her still further. What I have the right to do is to stop doing it. What I have the right to do is follow the instructions in the book. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. It's no secret that the so-called promises come in between 9 and 10. If you have not done your ninth step, you're going to be in for euphoria as you've never known it. If you haven't done your ninth step, get to it. Do the first eight first. Do the first eight first, but the ninth step is really so much a part of how I can live in the world emancipated. Let's do the promises, and then we're going to close. If you have questions, I'll take them. But I want to get to 10, 11, and 12 tomorrow morning. And some of you are sleeping, so let's try to hold it down a little bit. I do see that. I think dinner is at 6 o'clock. 7? Vayazmir. Okay, so we're going to finish. I want to finish the promises, and then we'll do a little Q&A if you want to, and then we'll break up and I'll give you some free time. I know a lot of you have been with me all day, and this is a long day. I do know that. I do appreciate that. And it's a lot of listening to the reading and stuff, and I do know that that's hard. I really do. But let's just get through the promises, and then we'll do a little Q&A, and then we'll let you and me take some free time. The spiritual life is not a theory we have to live in unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles. What are the spiritual principles? They are the steps. We think we ought not urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We talked about that. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves, we would write them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases. But we don't delay. We don't delay if it can be avoided. This is a note that says, you're fired. Shut up. Okay. Okay, for postponement. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Now, here are the so-called promises, and I love them, but there's promise. The reason I call them the so-called promises is, guys, there's promises all through this book from the very first page till the last page. There are just the existence of this book alone is the fulfillment of a promise. That I and those of us who are afflicted with compulsive overeating, we have a roadmap to be free of it. That promise. This is a God-given book for me. This is a God-given book for anyone who utilizes it and does what it says. In my opinion, it is the greatest way of life there is. It is the greatest way of life there is. Okay. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
We think not.
They are being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Very quickly, let's go to page 52. Because these are the promises of what we get if we do the work. And these are the bedevilments on page 52. The bedevilments are what happens if we don't do the work, finger wagging. Here's what happens if we don't. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness and were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. So you see the bedevilments on page 52. That's what happens if you don't do the work. And then on page 83, you see the unbelievable miracles and rewards of what happens when you do it. Now, before we throw it open for questions, I'm going to ask you to do me one huge favor. Please do not ask me if I eat hamburgers as opposed to cheeseburgers or stuff like that. Okay, because that's kind of a waste of time. Okay, anybody? Anything? Yes, back there. Hi, Jesse. I really do, because what happens is I sponsor people. We have an Into Action group in the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club, and I'm very lucky enough, very fortunate enough, to have several sponsees. And as I sponsor other people and I take them through the steps, I go through them with them too. And in doing 12, it's sort of like a loop. The steps are sort of like an infinitive loop. You just keep doing them again and again. Yes. Yeah.
I have a
There's stuff that they've unloaded or downloaded. One gal or one guy I've sponsored downloaded some stuff on the internet that has the columns. But basically, I just use a notebook of columns. And what I do with the four step is work down. In other words, all the people, places, and principles I resented. Then the second column. Blah, 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 blah. But what I want to make sure I do when I do the fourth step is I want to take my lead from Bill Wilson. The longest explanation of why I'm mad at somebody was 19 words. I am not going to sit and write a book, Why I'm Mad at So-and-So, because that's just going to rehash the resentment. So I'm limited to 19 words or less. But I just use five columns and then two columns for the fear and then answering the questions in the sexual inventory. But there is stuff online that a couple of the folks from our group has downloaded, but I'm sure you could find it. I just don't know how to. Yes, George.
You went over, you said this is the fourth column and then the fifth column, and I kind of missed where that was.
Page 67. It says, referring to our list again. We put out of our minds the wrongs others had done and looked at our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, self-seeking, frightened, dishonest, right? Because I don't have it in front of me. Okay. Yeah, that's the character defect is the fifth. The fourth column is what did I do to set the ball in motion? In other words, what's my part in it? And for me, the fourth column made the first three columns into a very different situation. I looked at things very differently after that. Yes. Yes. Up here, black.
Oh, yeah. I had a question about step
is that, because, and I kind of rebelled at that idea because I was like, I don't count as one of the people that I did damage to, even though I did, because it's selfish to make amends of yourself. But it didn't work, because it didn't work not to do so, because then I was like, if I, you know what I mean? If I continue to treat myself like garbage and hope to treat other people well and think that's virtuous to do so, you know what I mean? Do you make amends of yourself, or do you think that's an exercise in, like, gratuitous, like, being too nice to yourself?
Is the question in there, do I make amends to myself?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Okay. I make amends to, that's okay, I just wanted to be clear. The way I make amends to myself is to work the steps and recover. And in so doing, I will clear away that wreckage of the past, and that's how I make amends to myself. As my life grows in my spiritual life, as my work in OA grows, I find myself understanding that I'm just a human being and liking myself more and more, not to the point of egotistical rantings and ravings, but to the point where I can be humble. Humility is the God-given ability that God gives me to be one of many, to be part of the group. I don't have to walk in here contemptuous of all of you. I don't have to walk in here envious of all of you. I don't have to walk in here feeling like I'm better or worse than all of you. I come in here as part of the group, and that is the amends to me. Does that make more sense? Okay.
Thanks.
Yes.
Sponsees and relapse.
Sponsees and relapse. Sponsees and relapse, sometimes, unfortunately, if somebody is not working the steps and they do go into relapse, sometimes you have to ask yourself, is this a person who wants to recover? What are they doing today? What action are they taking today to demonstrate to me through action that they want to recover? If a person doesn't want to recover, there's pretty much nothing you can do. The food will beat them back to the rooms. If they don't want to recover, there's not much you can do except wish them well. And when they come back, welcome them. Yeah. Somebody, right, yeah.
With respect to step four inventory, there's two different, I want your opinion about this. In this, that give a little different illumination. On page 71, it says if you have made a decision and made an inventory of your grosser handicaps.
The grosser handicaps are going to be the inventory that at that point you have just finished. Your grosser handicaps are dishonesty, selfishness, self-seeking, fear, anger.
See, then on page 75, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past.
When you do your four step, you will do that. It will take care of itself, I promise you. On page 67, referring to our list again, where had we been selfish, self-seeking, frightened, dishonest? It's assumed you were angry there because it's a resentment inventory. So he doesn't repeat anger. But later on, he's going to throw anger in there as a defect of character. Is that it? One more, two more. Yeah, okay.
Some part of the big book says that
you'd have to show me that one where it says being oversensitive is a character defect. It says many of us are sensitive, but it does not say that being sensitive is a character defect. As a matter of fact, it says most of us are very sensitive people. And I think if you find we are, but you'd have to show me where it says that that's a defect, because I haven't seen it yet. One more, yeah. We land on a desert island, and you have all the supplies. And I want to manipulate you out of those supplies. I'm being self-seeking. We land on the same desert island. I have all the supplies and will not share necessities with you. That's selfish. Selfish is I'm hoarding. Self-seeking is I want something that you have because I feel like it would benefit me. I want your car, I want your whatever. Yes? No, it's not. Guilt comes as a remorse, guilt, shame, these various things will clear up as I work the steps. We see ourselves as human beings more and more as time goes on when we work the steps. But guilt is talked about there. Guilt, shame, remorse, horror, hopelessness, those kind of things are mentioned in the book. But it's not in that group of defects that we're in. That'll do it. Okay, we're done, and we will meet back here tomorrow. Thank you.